Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the five books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. You will discover there some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. One of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood, Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of Paul's first epistle to Timothy, a pastoral epistle. Paul is giving Timothy, his pastoral protege, who's functioning as a bishop in the church of Ephesus, instructions, as he put it, how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is no mean thing. The household of God is the church of the living God, the pillar and the support of the truth. So take it very seriously. It is very sacred. Listen carefully and do as I instruct, according to the dictates of the Holy Spirit. It's kind of a pastoral manual, after a fashion. In chapter 5, verse 3, the apostle, as we saw in our last study, was giving instructions about the church's support of widows. We had mentioned that in that society, it was a two-tiered society, and people tended to be rich or they tended to be relatively poor. And we see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, as I mentioned, where the majority of the people who belonged to the churches, there were exceptions, were nobodies. There were not many mighty, there were not many noble, there were not many well-born. And that was God's plan, and it still is. The church of Jesus Christ around the world is and has been, if it is his church, has been comprised largely of the little people. And in those days, there were no government programs, there were no means. All of this kind of thing has grown out of Christianity. Of course, the compassion of the wicked is cruel. The world perverts these things, tries to find ways to get the poor and others just off its collective conscience. And so it invented the welfare state, such things as socialism, all of which are destructive, all of which ruin human dignity. But nevertheless, the conscience in caring for the poor is an outgrowth of Christianity in the Western world, and now in the world at large. The church had to care for its own, and we pointed out that charity begins at home. So many times, we want to take our charity outside. We want to go out into the world with our money and our goods and wave our flag and say, hey, here we Christians come, we love you, and dump our load right in front of them and say, how's that? Aren't we great? Folks, we should love the world, but we should be like God. The love of God extends first to the family of God, and there's something wrong with any pastor who would go out caring for his flock and caring for the people in the community and neglect his own family. There's something wrong with the church, and there's something wrong with people that always want to run out and care for others and neglect the needy right in their own congregations. Now, I recognize in our congregations we have people who are seriously messed up. We have people who have terrible habits. We have people who make horrible financial decisions and put themselves behind the eight ball. They get themselves in such financial straits and stresses that it would take Rockefeller to bail them out. Buffett and all of his corporations. I'm exaggerating, of course, but all we can do for those people is try here and there to show them a little love, but we can't fix them until they fix themselves. But there are a lot of people, and there were in Paul's day, a lot of people who were just plain poor and not through any fault of their own, if given half a chance, if given a little breathing room, could make the best of it. And that's exactly what we ought to do. Start at home. Charity begins at home, and it especially begins with our families. So to review what the apostle said and then move on, he said in verse 3, honor widows who are widows indeed. That is, support them. You show your honor by supporting them. If any widow has children or grandchildren, they don't qualify as what I call a widow indeed. Let the family first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family. Don't put that burden on the church and expect the church to do it. That's something you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to dump your widows. You're not supposed to dump granny. You're not supposed to dump mom and dad unnecessarily into some home somewhere where they kind of disappear from sight and are neglected. Sometimes that has to be done. But where it doesn't have to be done, don't be selfish. You take care of them. Let them make some return to their parents. For this is acceptable. It's pleasing in the sight of God for us to do that. Remember, honor your parents, the law of God said. We're not saved by keeping the law, but those who are saved like to keep God's law. Now, she who is a widow indeed, he further defines that, and who's been left alone, and her dependency is totally upon the Lord, and she is a very devout person. She continues in entreaties and prayers day and night. That's who I mean, Paul says, by one is a widow indeed. Let the church step up and do all they can to support such a one. But there's another kind of widow, the kind who gives herself to wanton pleasure. Hubby's now dead, and now I'm going to kick up my heels. She tipped her hat, as Hendrickson said, toward religion, but now she's going the other way. Well, such a person is dead even while she lives. So prescribe these things as well, so that they may be above reproach. Not only the widows, but the church may act in a responsible way, so they're above reproach. But he adds, and this is included in that, being above reproach, verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his own family. Boy, this is serious. This is heavy. If anyone, you or me or anyone else, when we can, if we do not provide for our own families, not only our children, our wives, or our husbands, as the case may be, we don't care for them when they need care. We don't care for father or mother when they need us. We don't care for grandparents, most especially if they're believing parents or grandparents. Well, that person has denied the faith. In effect, that person is an apostate. They can go to church, carry their big Bibles, sing, serve on committees, and perform all these religious functions, but in fact, they're worse than an unbeliever. Boy, that is a heavy-duty indictment. Now, in verse 9, the apostle continues talking about this widow situation because it was a big problem in the early church due to the economic structure of society. Let a widow be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation of good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the feet of saints, and if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. So he further narrows and defines those that the church are to support, to undertake the burden of sustaining them. The apostle now turns from directions about ministering to the needs of widows to giving direction about the work of widows. There are a variety of views about just what categories of widows he has in mind. We acknowledge that. To all except one of them, I think there are strong objections. Rather than run through the whole litany of suggestions, refuting them one by one, I will simply offer you the interpretation I believe presents the fewest difficulties. I always used to tell my students when I was teaching hermeneutics, which is the art and science of biblical interpretation, the best interpretation is always the one that explains the most and leaves you with the fewest problems. Should you ever wish to get into all the alternatives that I'm bypassing here, I'll just recommend that you look at William Hendrickson's commentary on the Pastoral Epistles in the New Testament Commentary Series. His view seems to me to have the most going for it. His view is, namely, that the church has maintained a formal register of widows qualified to discharge certain delicate or other ministry functions in the church, and I think among these would have been widows indeed. What the apostle here does is impart to Timothy good counsel about the qualifications these widows should have. All these qualifications are appropriate to establishing their character and their fitness for their sensitive ministries. And they're all qualifications designed to specifically exclude certain other widows for reasons good for them and good for the churches. Now, we do know from the writings of the early church fathers that there was such a role, widow role, maintained. And we know that those widows registered on it had duties. That's good, because they weren't made welfare clients. They had duties, such as giving counsel to younger women. Among their duties was praying and fasting and visiting the sick and preparing women for baptism, taking them the communion cup, because many of them could not be, perhaps, in services, and giving guidance and direction to widows and orphans who were supported by the church. There are a couple things we can learn by way of application here. One is, we do not want to damage people and the church by setting people up for failure when we can see easily that the job and their life circumstances do not match up well. And two, we in our churches need to be more rigorous than we tend to be about making sure those we invite to serve in any capacity are qualified. And thirdly, we sometimes have hidden resources. Another lesson here. We have hidden resources in our church bodies that we need to do a better job of finding a ministry for, and of course, among those were widows in these churches. Now the apostle lists the qualifications for the widows register. Whatever the compass of them was, and I think many of the widows indeed, would have been in that register, but maybe not all. First of all, one qualification, she's got to be at least 60 years old. Verse 11 will explain the reasoning behind this requirement. Let a widow be put on the list only if she's not less than 60, having been the wife of one man. Verse 11 says, but refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desires in disregard of Christ, they want to get married. Thus they incur condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. So that goes to the reasoning about not less than 60 years old. There are young widows, and there are older widows, and there are middle-aged widows. And you don't want to put, he says, widows on this register who are too young. Another qualification is having been the wife of one man. Marital integrity is the point, just as in the case of elders and deacons. This requirement does not mean that she could not have been twice married in the sense that her first husband may have died, and then as a widow, she had remarried, the second died also. Having a second husband under that circumstance would not, I believe, disqualify her, for as we see in verse 14, younger widows are encouraged to remarry. There's no discredit attached to that. The point is marital fidelity, and marital fidelity in an honorable marriage is a qualifying point. Those widows who are on this church register and serve in these ministry capacities are to be women. They're to be scrutinized just like elders and just like deacons are. They're to have a reputation for good works. If by this time a widow has not acquired a reputation for reaching out and assisting others in need, hey, clearly it's unlikely that putting her in a position where such good deeds and such beneficence are of the essence in the work, that's not likely to cause her now to turn on. Time has tested her, so let time speak for itself. Another qualification. If she has brought up children. Now, a woman who's never had the experience of rearing and nurturing children may not be her fault at all, of course. Such a lady is obviously not the best candidate to counsel young mothers and care for orphans and foundlings. This is not to say that they can do no good. It's not to say if forced to do so, a mother instinct will not be awakened. But it is to say that if one's going to set up a society of widows whose charge it is to deal with this sort of thing, among others, the best candidates are women experienced in motherhood. That just makes sense. Another qualification is if she's washed the saints' feet. Well, in that world, that was a humble service to the saints, especially caring for traveling preachers. The roads were dusty, people wore sandals, and it's just like, I invite you to a meal, I invite you to go in and to wash your hands. Who knows where all you've been and what all you've touched? So we're going to have dinner, you go wash your hands. In those days, you went in and you washed your feet, and that was a menial task, but it was an important social service of hospitality. So if she's washed saints' feet, especially caring for traveling preachers, as did Lydia, for Paul and his entourage back in Acts 16:14, if she's shown hospitality to strangers, those two kind of go together, these graces are also qualifications for this widow's roster. They're qualifications for shepherds, too. You see, that was a cruel and often unaccommodating world. In a Roman world, they had a good road system. There were a lot of travelers. There were inns. But the kind of innkeeping structure that we know today did not exist in that day. But besides that, Christians were often persecuted, and they were often in flight. Christians or not, it was just a good virtue to accept strangers under one's roof and provide them with food and shelter. And he's thinking, stranger Christians. All Christians should do that when it is appropriate. But those who lead should by all means set the example. There are times, however, when it's not appropriate. Let's acknowledge that. When I was just a little boy, I'm guessing 6 years old, my dad was working the night shift. It was a wild and stormy night in our little town of Pratt, West Virginia. Boom, 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 lightning everywhere. Two men came banging on our front door in the middle of the night when Dad was working and Mom was there alone with us three boys. It was absolutely sheer terror. That was no time to throw open the door and invite two male strangers in. That would have been completely inappropriate. But I remember, on the other hand, what my parents did for a friend of ours by the name of Harvey, taking him in after a fashion. He lived down the road for us on a Red Dog slag road, maybe a couple miles, lived in basically a shanty. His parents didn't know God from the backside of a barn. They were wastrels. But Harvey had something, and he took himself to school, and Mom and Dad kind of picked him up like a stray dog. We had him in our house a great deal, feeding him and giving him hospitality. Further qualification for widows on this register is that she must be one who's known for assisting those in distress, not necessarily strangers, but people in her church and community, and be one who's devoted herself to every good work. You can see that there is a vein in which these qualifications run. It reiterates in a general and strengthened way the overarching qualification for these ladies. The previous ones are just subsets. This is the kind of widow that should be enrolled for this ministry, to the exclusion of all others. Widowhood itself, you see, was not a qualification. The assumption is that these widows were being supported by the church, but they were not welfare clients. As I say, I think most of them were widows indeed. Now, there's some confusion in there, and I acknowledge that. In any case, it was a formal register. But there is a set of widows that are not to go on there, verse 11, refuse to put younger widows on the list. He says in verse 11, youth often has its advantages, but not for this ministry. Enrolling younger widows may set them against their own strong natural tendencies. It may set younger widows up for calamitous spiritual failure. Paul explains what is likely to happen if young women took a vow, and apparently these widows took a vow to enter this ministry. If you get young women taking a vow to give themselves over to the Lord to perform this ministry, and then under the pressures of youth they renege, that'll do a savage job on the conscience when they feel sensual desires and disregard of Christ. He says, then they want to get married. They incur condemnation or judgment because they've set aside their previous pledge. Now, here's the problem the apostle envisions with admitting younger widows to the roles. Not the roles of the church, but this widow roster, which had this defined ministry that we discussed earlier. It's not that they feel sensual desires and eventually want to get married. That's not the problem in itself. It's normal for most unmarried people. Paul didn't happen to be one, apparently. But it's normal for most unmarried people, both men and women, to feel those desires and to wish to marry or remarry. There's nothing reproachable in that itself, not at all. Where things jump track spiritually is when someone is induced to take a vow to relinquish this liberty. I mean, it's for a lifetime. To take a vow before God. It's like our marriage vows. We take that vow, and they took a vow to devote themselves to serving Christ in the manner prescribed for widows. Well, it would be a serious thing to abandon that sacred pledge to Christ, and it's one that would bring divine censure upon them. It's a serious thing to make any kind of vow to God, marriage vow or otherwise, and then turn one's back on it, as if it were a light thing to be dismissed, when a stronger desire comes along and intrudes itself upon the human will. Back in Numbers chapter 30, verses 1 and following, the people of Israel are instructed about the sacredness of their vows to God. We'd do well to take heed to that today. It was, and it is, a serious offense to heaven itself to fail to follow through. That's what you mean by taking the name of the Lord in vain. It's not certain profanity you hear so much. It's that. You see, it's all a matter of respect for God. And in this case, it's a matter of respect for His Son, the Lord of glory, whose service they set aside in favor of marriage. Nothing wrong with marriage. It's when they take a vow, a sacred vow to God as widows, younger widows, and say, we're going to devote ourselves entirely to Christ and to His service. Oops, all of a sudden, I see a guy like, I start having those sensual feelings and I want to get married. I turn my back on that. Now that involves divine censure. Condemns refers to the censure of the Holy Spirit in the conscience. Does not necessarily refer to damnation, as though such an action was deemed the behavior of an apostate, though that could be the case. With the censure of a grieved Holy Spirit comes naturally a profound sense of guilt before God, and this is a problem. The dangerous thing about guilt, especially heavy guilt, is that if it's not resolved in a biblical way, but if that guilt is allowed to sit around, soak and sour, guilt can, like some acidic chemical, eat away at the innards of our faith. For guilt destroys bit by bit one's confidence toward God. So Paul knows it's truly a dangerous thing to put young widows in a position where there is a strong, foreseeable possibility of them reneging on their vow to Christ owing to their youth. In the end, they may wreck their conscience and stumble, possibly even to a degree fatal to faith. But the potential pitfalls with putting younger widows off the marriage market and enrolling them in this widow ministry is that maturity-wise and energy-wise, they're not ready for this in enough cases that it makes sense just to draw a line on them and say, no, not them, not now. At the same time, Paul says they learn to be idle as they go around from house to house, not merely idle, but they become gossips and busybodies talking about things not proper. What the apostle also fears from this vocational mismatch is too much unemployed youthful energy plus too much immaturity will combine to create a deadly combustion of idleness, meddlesomeness, gossipiness, and general unwholesomeness. All of that will have a deleterious effect on the health of the church, not to mention the individuals involved. So let those younger widows get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. By getting them involved in all of these vices and stirring up the carnal juices, toxifying the body, and giving the enemy occasion to accuse and smear the people of God for their excesses. So be smart. Don't go there, the apostle says. Well, we've got to come back to that next time. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.